the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Brooke is back, so that's probably the most important thing to announce before we get started. But we are going to discuss historic political ads, campaign slogans, because we're getting closer to that Labor Day season where its traditional campaign starts to kick up a notch, and it'll be in the news. We're going to discuss the sad story of Cannon Hennett, who was murdered in Wilson, North Carolina, a little five-year-old boy. Hasn't got a lot of media attention nationally, some local attention, of course, but I've actually been reading more about it in the British media. Joe Biden has selected Kamala Harris, and the latest Civitas polls, which I know you all are interested in. So, Brooke, welcome back.
Hey, you know what? It is good to be back. So I enjoyed listening to you and Andrew's talk last week, and I'm sure our audience did. But I'll tell you what, I got stuff to talk about, so I'm glad I'm here.
Absolutely. And Andrew does get credit because I was also going to have a different guest on, but there were some technical problems. And Andrew stepped in on like 10 minutes notice. So credit to him.
He's the best.
He really is. I mean, he was willing to just go with whatever I talked about. And he's got enough knowledge where he could help carry the podcast, obviously. So he was a big boon for the show. So you and I, just before we started, we were talking about campaign ads and historical ads, and also just the slogans that presidential campaigns have had throughout history. And there's been some really good ones. There's obviously been some bad ones. Brooke, what are a couple of your favorite? Because I love this stuff. I love American history and especially campaign history. What are a couple slogans that stick out to you that were effective or that you maybe remember?
Okay, yeah. So I thought this would be a fun topic, especially because you have just a vast library of historic knowledge of all manner of American government stuff. But a few of the ones that really stood out to me, and I apologize if I steal any of your thunder, but I'm the lesser one on this conversation, so I'm going to do it anyways. But I like Ronald Reagan's one, It's Morning Again in America. I thought that was beautiful, and it's just kind of poetic, and I'm a poet at heart. I really like poetry. And so I thought that was really good. George H.W. Bush's Kinder, Gentler Nation. I don't know if that's very catchy, but I like it. These are things that are aspirational. Both Ronald Reagan's, George H.W. Bush's, and also Barack Obama's Hope and Change. I think that those are the ones that, at least in recent memory, I think really contribute to that part of America that is very aspirational and striving and forward-looking. And I think that really taps into the American spirit. And of course, we know Make America Great Again. I mean, that's something that's trying to pull us forward or keep America great again. And so I think that those are the best kind of slogans, or those ones that remind us kind of who we are by helping us look forward. But what about you?
No, I think you pegged one of the most, at least in my lifetime, the biggest one. It's Morning Again in America, or it's a Morning Again in America from Ronald Reagan. I know he had a very expensive ad company. Have you seen the TV ads from that, Brooke? There's three or four commercials that were just infamous from 1984 that really, I think, had an effective pull on the nation. Because, I mean, if you're looking at the 70s, you're coming out of this period malaise. Jimmy Carter basically said we had lost our confidence, and America had a crisis of confidence, and we had huge inflation problems at the beginning of the Reagan administration. And then you have this miraculous economic recovery. And of course, it's not all to Reagan's credit. I mean, some of it was just maybe a natural economic cyclical, but he did slash taxes and do some stuff to spur some growth. And those ads were just very effective, and it made people believe in America again after just basically a decade of struggles and inflation policies. I mean, they had those whip inflation now buttons that were popular back in the day, and the gas lines and the hostage crisis. And so it really was this kind of rebuilding time and just the spirit of optimism that retook America. And of course, Reagan went on to win every state except for Walter Mondale's home state of Minnesota. It was one of the most lopsided electoral victories in history. So that definitely sticked out to me. And before we got on, you know, we were looking at some of the ones, and I mentioned Nixon's the one. I just read a book recently on the election of 1968, and Nixon's the one was a very effective slogan. But at the Democratic convention, of course, which had a bunch of riots and different things in Chicago, there were a bunch of pregnant ladies who showed up, and they had like little placards around their bodies saying Nixon's the one, kind of poking fun at his slogan, meaning that he was the father of their child.
Yeah, there were a few on Wikipedia that I was looking at related to Nixon that I shan't repeat, but they were a little wild, I'd say. And so I'm not surprised by that, but they had a lot of fun with Nixon's nickname. So
yeah, and I like Ike is probably one of the most infamous ones from Eisenhower. It just obviously rhymes so easily, and Eisenhower won his race easily both times, and he was a very popular president. And I like Ike is just kind of infamous. Those buttons I have a political campaign. I haven't dug them out in years, but I have a collection of buttons from political campaigns going back to like 1896. So some of them are old.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I've got some from both parties, of course, and they're just kind of cool because I kind of like the history and the slogans. And I had a great aunt that she collected antiques, and she would always buy me political buttons as well. And so,
I'm not surprised that you have this. I'll be honest with you. That is like totally on brand for you.
Yeah. I just love American history and, campaign season. You know, the policy is interesting to me, but the campaign stuff can just be so over the top, especially nowadays. It really can be fun to follow, even though, you know, we're in a time where the nation's just so broken in many respects from a political perspective. But, you know, campaign season's always still kind of fun. I mean, there's just, it's the funny gaffes, the excitement, the rallies, which will be different, obviously, this year. But, you know, it just, Nixon had a famous saying where he talked about, you know, America's messed up, but there's nothing that a good campaign can't fix. And I don't really think that's true so much anymore, but I think that resonates with a lot of people still, that, you know, they think that we'll get a reboot or a recharge. Certainly a lot of people who don't like Trump or are mad about Trump feel like, you know, they're going to be very optimistic if their candidate wins or if they can just get Trump out of there. So, yeah, all this stuff's interesting to talk about. So anything else on political commercials, maybe from that you remember that were just really effective or funny ads?
Well, actually, so nothing from historic campaign slogans at the moment, but one that actually Civitas made the news in was WRAL did a recent fact check on, I think it was the North Carolina Republican Party, or the Senate majority, the North Carolina Senate majority. And no, the National Republican Senate majority ran an ad against Cal Cunningham, the Democratic candidate. And they said that Cal Cunningham voted for $1 billion in new taxes. And so anyways, WRAL, which as many of you know, leans left, but we've had Andy Spey, who is their now fact checker. We've had him on the podcast in the past. So he wrote this article and did this fact check on whether or not that claim was true. And they rated it as mostly true. But Brian Balfour, our EVP, was actually cited in this and just basically kind of unpacked the tax situation and regressive taxes in our state. So anyways, you can find that story at WRAL. It's called Fact Check. Ad says Cunningham voted for $1 billion in new taxes. But yeah, so that's, I mean, political ads are still highly political, even in 2020, but they have been historically, and some of them are zingers, some political slogans are zingers, I mean, and sometimes the ads can be misleading, but it's politics, isn't it?
Yeah, and all of you know, great points, Brooke, especially for highlighting that story. All of you know Mitch McConnell, he's the majority leader, Republican majority leader in the Senate. he had a very famous ad that was effective, and I think it was copied. It may even have been copied in North Carolina, but it was copied in a couple other states where he was running against an opponent. And I think this was the first time when he ran and won a House seat or something. It may have been before the Senate, or it may have been the Senate race. I don't remember. But it was a bunch of bloodhounds. He was running against an opponent who missed like way too many votes. And so each commercial was like a different segment or scene of these bloodhounds running through town or the forest searching for this, you know, his opponent, because they couldn't find him because he was missing so many votes. And it was almost like a little soap opera, and it caught people's attention. It was a very effective ad. You could probably find it on YouTube. I haven't seen it in a while, or I'd probably explain it a little better. But it had bloodhounds basically searching for the candidate. And I know that in history, other campaigns use that against people who maybe just missed too many votes in Congress. So right. It was a very powerful ad. And McConnell knew what he was doing, and he had people around him that knew what he was doing with that ad. And so it was very effective. And of course, we could talk all day about ads. We don't have time to do that. I'd love to, but let's jump to the big news right now, Brooke. Kamala Harris was just selected by Joe Biden to be vice president. I think a lot of people thought she was certainly one of the finalists because she'd been floated and her name had been released. But also, Biden said he was going to pick a black woman at one time, and which he did. So what is your kind of thoughts? Let's try to break this down, because we can't talk about everything. But what are your thoughts how this might help or hurt him in North Carolina?
That's a good question. I think it comes down to public perception in across the state among voters in terms of their concerns in their perception of crime and violence in the state. And you have written about this in the growing violence and crime in Charlotte. Kamala Harris is definitely one that would be readily recognized as more of a law and order candidate on the left, as opposed to like a Bernie Sanders. And so I think that if Biden's trying to appeal to that crowd in North Carolina, those progressives, then that's great. But if he's trying to capture that Black Lives Matter, defund the police, more younger electorate, I think the Kamala Harris pick really hurts him. And so it will be interesting to see how that plays out. But I saw a post, this is purely anecdotal, but I saw a post from a left-leaning progressive friend of mine on Facebook, and she said, you know, I might disagree with 10% of the Biden-Harris ticket's policy platform, but it's better than the 70% I disagree with on Trump. And so some of them are rationalizing it like that, you know, kind of how many Republicans did in 2016, in terms of saying the lesser of two evils, even so they maybe didn't want to vote for Trump, but they sure weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. So,
yeah, let me ask you something else. Do you think, I think your analysis is dead on, but do you think Kamala will run from her past record? Because look, you're right. It was a very law and order oriented record. She put a lot of folks in jail. She went after kind of low-level drug abusers, put them in jail. Of course, there's that famous quote from the debate where Tulsi jumped on her because she, I guess, in an interview laughed when they asked her if she smoked marijuana, but then she bragged other times of putting drug offenders in jail, especially low-level marijuana abusers, for lack of a better word, perhaps. But do you think, my point is, do you think she's going to run from that and try to be someone she's not, at least from a record standpoint?
Whew, that's a good question. And I mean, can they rebrand her and remake her? Possibly, but it's a little late in the game to do that. And I don't know. I mean, it depends on how many PACs that oppose her, how much money they have, I think, in sort of keeping the heat up on bad advertising, calling up her record. So she might try to overlook it. The media, the mainstream media will give her a pass, I think.
I think that's the key. I think the media will by and large give her a pass on that, at least cable news, you know, outside of maybe Fox. But I think the cable media will by and large give her a pass on that. And I think she'll embrace that. She's this sort of reformer, Black Lives Matter movement cheerleader, which she really wasn't. even historically. You know, I think she's made statements in support, obviously, and continues to do that, but her actions are different. But, you know, vice presidential candidates sometimes have an advantage to reinvent themselves because really they say that they leave some of their agenda behind and say, well, I just embrace the presidential nominee's agenda now. I mean, this was, you know, Reagan picked Bush in 1980, and Bush ran a lot of negative ads against Reagan when he ran against him in 1980. Of course, he had the voodoo economics statement from Bush against Reagan, and he embraced Reagan's agenda as any loyal vice presidential nominee will do. So I'm certainly Mike Pence didn't historically agree with a lot of the stuff that Trump talks about today. And he embraces that agenda today because that's the job of the vice president, to be loyal and to be a chameleon and to change their stripes. So it'll
but
be
okay. Let me ask this real quick before we move on. There are some really egregious things that Harris implied that Biden was guilty of or complicit in, such as sexual harassment and racism. So, I mean, where do you draw the line between we just have policy disagreements versus like you're a really horrible person? And so I think that like there is just such hypocrisy, it seems to me. And then she was asked this actually by, I think, Stephen Colbert. And she was just like, it was a debate. It was a debate. That's why I said those things. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that is just so shallow. And I mean, sure doesn't pass muster in my books, because if I know someone's a sexual harasser or a racist, I want to go the opposite direction of them. I don't care if they're a stepping stone toward my political ascendancy. I mean, that's just like a first principle issue. And I got problems with her on that front.
Oh, Brooks got problems. Brooks got problems.
Anyways, I'm getting worked up about that. So maybe.
No, I think you raise a good point. You raise a good point, obviously. And a lot of people are talking about this. Can she, when she says she's believed the woman that accused, at least one woman I know about, who's been made public, a very, you know, this is not like I grabbed you around the waist and pulled you close to me and whispered in your ear. There was, I'm not going to describe it on this podcast. You can go read about it. But Biden assaulted her, sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a clear assault. It's not like around the margins. So yeah,
it's not harassment. It's assault. It was assault that he was accused of by her.
Right, and accused of. And there's so much to unpack there, Brooke. I mean, clearly, people that make it in politics this high are they will trample over other people to get where they want. I mean, this is true on the right and the left. This is not just something that Democrats do. So she clearly has. If you read about her, she's clearly sacrificed things in her life to get to the top. In many ways, I mean that. So, you know, she's somebody that is willing to, I think, put aside principles, put aside any sort of foundational beliefs to get to the top. I think she understands that she has a good chance of becoming president if Joe Biden wins. Joe Biden, to me, doesn't look like he would make it through two terms. I could be wrong, could be underestimating him. But just from some of the, you know, interviews you see and just some of the media reports, he may not make it two terms. He's kind of lost a little bit of his mojo, so to speak. But he's also, you know, a very talented politician to be where he is today and to have the patience. I mean, he's a guy that has run for president twice before and failed. Had a big plagiarism scandal, as I remember as a boy in 1988. So, you know, I think you can answer that just as good as I can. And I think Kamala Harris sees this is her opportunity to seize. And she sees it. And a big respect, it is just politics to her. You know, it's just her saying stuff, her pandering to people, and her, you know, positioning herself in a way that she needs to be to be president potentially. So, you know, that's maybe a little bit of a cynical look at it, and maybe she doesn't really believe it and she was just virtue signaling, and that's possible too. So who knows? But she is going to be well positioned because Trump's got a lot of problems now, and Biden's in a good position at this date. I mean, I don't think this really kicks off where people start really paying attention until after Labor Day, but you know, this is, she's in a good spot to be president. And that scares me a little bit, given her ideological background So
yeah. Yeah. Well, but you know, you just mentioned right now that Trump is, President Trump is not necessarily in the best position politically right now, at least according to a number of public opinion polls and ours that we released at the time of this recording, just a few hours before this recording, indicates that things are very, very tight here in North Carolina right now. And of course, anything can change. And, you know, public opinion is kind of a fickle thing. It can sway with the wind. And as much as we like to think that we're consistent people, there are often times wherein we just kind of vote. Some of us, not our audience, of course, but some of us really do kind of just go with the wind in whichever way it's blowing. And so we'll see what happens on election day. But as of right now, let's dig into some of these results that we have. And the latest one where we polled 600 likely voters in North Carolina, and that's an important distinction among rather than just 600 registered voters. These are people that have consistently voted. So they're the best indication of how the electorate is going. 44% of them said they planned on voting for Donald Trump in November. 45% said they planned on voting for Joe Biden. And then 2% for Joe Jorgensen, the Libertarian candidate. 1% for Don Blankenship, the Constitution Party candidate. And 1% for Howie Hankins, or is it Hawkins, who is the Green Party candidate. And 7% are undecided. Who are these undecided people?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're undecided, I will actually, because I usually don't defend the undecided people, Brooke, because, you know, you hear all these, like, there's 15% undecided people in these presidential races, and you're like, who are these idiots, you know? And I'm trying to be somewhat kind there, because I do have a low view of them. If you're not paying attention at all, do you not have any kind of worldview that you can base your vote on? You know, they're almost like fickle. You see these people brought into these rooms on CNN or Fox News, and the all sacred undecided voters. And it's like, really? But in this case, I think a lot of people don't see either candidate as very ideal. So maybe they haven't made up their mind. You know, you may not like Trump at all, given his brashness, given some of his own statements, given some of his own history. And then Biden is just a relic from the Democratic Party. And look, I'm going to criticize Biden here. I criticize Trump from time to time. He seems like a Manchurian candidate to me. He's bending with the wind. Historically, he's more of a – he's not a hard liberal. He was really more of a moderate to kind of lurching leftward Democrat for most of his Senate career. He's moved to the left in the last decade, but he's really, really moving to the left now. And I think he's by and large controlled by kind of Democratic operatives or big money people. And he kind of just seems a little bit like a Manchurian candidate to me. And North Carolina will be critical. I think Trump has to win North Carolina to have any chance, because I don't think he's going to be quite as strong in the Midwest as he was this last time. So I think North Carolina is obviously the critical state for him. If Trump loses North Carolina, I just think that obviously just means bigger problems for Republicans nationally.
Yeah, no, it's critical. And I'm not just saying that because we're in North Carolina, but it really is a battleground state. And you can see that evidenced in just the composition of our council of state. You know, we've got the Democratic governor, Republican lieutenant governor, Democratic attorney general, Republican treasurer, and the list goes on. And so we are very much a purple state that is in play at the national and state levels. So this election is going to be interesting, but hey, let's also talk about, not forget, we have two other really, really close races. Well, one of them's close, which is the U.S. Senate race, Tom Tillis and Cal Cunningham. Tillis is actually underwater now, and he is behind Cal Cunningham for the first time in our polling, I think. So Cal Cunningham is coming 41% and Tillis at 38%.
Yeah, and it was the first time Biden led in our polls, I believe, as well. So, you know, even though they're both within the margin of error, I think Tillis is going to lose this race, Brooke. And that's just my opinion, not any official Civitas opinion, of course. I can always change. Stuff always changes in politics. I do think that people will start paying a little bit more attention and may pay attention to more about, you know, Cal Cunningham's liberalism. He tries to run as a moderate. He's more far left than most people realize. Of course, I think that's true of Cooper too, and that never really materialized with some of the voters. So, you know, but I think a big problem for Tillis is that there's a lot of undecided people. Undecided people tend to break for the challenger in open races like this, or in races like this, and that Tillis is still, what, how long has he been a senator? 4 or 5 years, 5 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a long time to have this many undecided people in a race, and they just usually go for the challenger. This is just, historically, that's what happens. If you have a lot of undecided voters in a Senate race like this, they tend to break for the challengers late in the race. And Cal Cunningham has a lot of money. Democrats are going to spend a lot of money to try to win back the Senate. They're very aggressive in this. Schumer's raising money all over the place so he can have a majority. Arizona's probably another state where Republicans might fall. I think Colorado is a potential one where Republicans are going to fall. They may pick up one in Alabama. There's some other states where they, you know, I think they're defending like 23 seats and Democrats only have to defend 12. So Republicans are at a disadvantage in this cycle. And if they lose the presidency, then it's going to be a kind of complete disaster for them to lose the Senate and the presidency. You'll have united government, at least in theory, for the Democrats. So yeah, I mean, it's an important race, like you said. I mean, North Carolina is essential.
Right. But maybe if the Democrats gain control of the White House, the Senate, and retain control of the House, they'll be about as ineffective as the Republicans were the first 2 years.
Do you think anybody could really be that ineffective?
I'm sorry?
Do you think anybody could really be that ineffective?
Well, they proved they were.
Yeah. Paul Ryan, man, he was a complete disaster as Speaker. And so I think I can't really, you know who had it reminded me of Jimmy Carter. Historically, he had super majorities, I think, in the Senate, because this was post Watergate, and the House, and he couldn't get his agenda through. That's how bad it was for Carter. As a Democrat, he just had a hard time getting his agenda through. And so, you saw that with the Trump and Republicans early in that tenure as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll see what happens, but kind of like, this is 2020. I think everybody has basically learned to just accept that sometimes the inevitable might not actually be inevitable, and things will change at the drop of a dime, and we just kind of have to buckle up and shore ourselves, sturdy ourselves, steady ourselves, and I think, you know, one of my takeaways during these just highly political seasons is just how important community is, how important it is to actually love your neighbor more. And this is just kind of a sidebar thing and just musing, but there's so many people that put so much hope and stock in politics. And believe me, I mean, Ray and I are in this field because we believe policy is important and it's a way that we can love our neighbors politically. But there's more to life than this. And I think that it's kind of when you're not seeing progress on this front that you are invited to wake up to the fact that there are other ways in which we can make this world a better place that, you know, aren't within the political realm. So,
amen. I mean, it's the secular materialists ultimately who put all their chips and hope into politics because it's all there is, right? I mean, there's no afterlife. There's no belief in a resurrection. There's no belief in greater hope and united, you know, being united with your family, whether your earthly family or your church family. So ultimately, that's what they look to, right? I mean, that's the kind of the secular materialist mindset that the here and now is all there is. And if you believe that, you know, I'm not criticizing you, so to speak. Well, I am criticizing you, but you have a right to believe that. And, you know, so if you believe that though, that you will live and die by the elections now because everything's so political and everything's about, you know, creating this sort of utopian society, at least in your mind, here and now. And if you don't have that, then you will lose hope. And then you will, like, you know, melt down and be a meme on Instagram or Twitter.
And no one really wants their legacy to be a meme or Instagram, or I mean, a meme on Instagram or Twitter. I'm just saying, for the most part, no sane person wants that. So, but hey, before we close out, let's go ahead and let's at least honor the memory. I know it's really hard to talk about the tragedy of this 5-year-old boy named Cannon Hennett that was in, from Wilson, North Carolina, but we want to honor his memory that he was tragically murdered very recently. I think it was last week.
Yes.
And so he looks like such a sweet little boy, and I have a 6-year-old little boy, and you have 2 little boys, and my heart goes out to his mother and his father, and just the tragedy that this is.
Yeah, really, like you said, Brooke, unspeakable tragedy. It's hard to even talk about. I was very emotionally affected, and a lot of people on social media are calling out or indicting the media for creating a lot of silence in this story because it was a black on white crime, and it was a neighbor that basically shot him in cold blood in front of his 2 sisters. And I don't know the full backstory, and I don't know if the media is really even knows the full backstory and maybe what gone on. I know it was initially reported, and this may be true, I'm not denying this, that he maybe accidentally rode through the yard of a neighbor or something, but it seems like maybe there's more that could have been going on there. But it's just tragic, and it's just sad to even contemplate that we live in a society like this, that this can happen. And, I don't really know what else to say, but just sending out prayers and thoughts and encouragement to that family, because, there's nothing that can be said or done to alleviate the pain that they must be feeling. And you're right, he looked like such a sweet boy. And I've been reading about it in the British media. I haven't, I saw it on Twitter just, I think it was yesterday, but it happened over the weekend. And I go, why didn't I hear about this story? Because I saw it was in Wilson, North Carolina. And my wife works with a lot of people from Wilson. She didn't mention it. I know it was on the local news there. But, the British media have been covering it really extensively. And I'm surprised. And I'm not blaming the governor for this. It's obviously not his fault. But I do think he should speak to this. I think he needs to say something about these kind of crimes, that they're not going to be accepted in North Carolina. This is not acceptable behavior. And can we do something to really remember Cannon and to just lift up his tragedy in a way that will at least have some redeeming qualities for the people that are left behind and have to deal with this kind of world, and his family that have to deal with his death. And it's just heartbreaking. I can't really talk about it too much, but it is heartbreaking. And I do want to give thanks to the people that are trying to at least get his name out there. Yes. I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I've got my friend Steve Noble. He is a radio host that covers most of North Carolina, and he's been covering this as well. And so I'm just appreciative of those that are, and those that are going to I believe there's a vigil this evening to show their support and just love on the family. And so our prayers go out to the Hennett family as well. But let's go ahead and we've got just another minute, but I wanted to encourage fellow North Carolinians that North Carolina has made a little bit of progress in our economic outlook. And I know that is something that is a major concern all across the U.S. right now, as people try to put food on the table and take care of their families during this crazy time. But North Carolina this year in the Rich States, Poor States Index, which is put out by the American Legislative Exchange Council, bumped North Carolina's ranking up to 5th. It was 6th last year. But basically, they look at metrics such as the state's tax reforms and our tax cuts, our low corporate tax rate, as well as our types of economic regulations and state government debt ratio and things like that. And so North Carolina is making progress and once again proves that fiscally conservative measures work.
Yeah, no doubt. North Carolina is well positioned. Unfortunately, this COVID thing completely derailed so much of our progress, but if it wasn't for conservative leaders and lawmakers that have really well positioned us for a recovery from this, I think the hope would be almost non-existent. So, and I know Del Fala has done yeoman's work to really try to shore up the pension system in this state and to keep the spending accountable in different agencies. across state government. So that's all encouraging. And I hope, you know, and pray that we could just continue to have a low tax, low regulatory climate going forward, because we're going to need that to recover, because this COVID stuff will end one day. And it seems like we've been saying that for a long time and it hasn't, but it will, Brooke. And, you know, we need to have the right policies in place so people can flourish in this state. And so people can go back to work if they don't have work now, that they'll have opportunities, hopefully even better opportunities than they had beforehand. Because I know that there's going to be a lot of creative destruction. Hopefully some of it will be good creative destruction and create more opportunities for people to work and provide for their families in the state. So you're exactly right. This is a key issue. And I hope voters, you know, wherever they stand, will, especially when you have a federal government that's almost $30 trillion in debt, wherever you stand, your Democrat, Republican, right or left, that you'll take fiscal responsibility into account. And, you know, Republicans at the national level haven't done a good job of that. So, you know, that's a reminder that this is not a one party issue. And so mm-hmm. you know, I hope people just pay attention yeah. to this stuff when they go into the voting booth and vote, because it really does make a difference. And it really, I think in this COVID environment, it is even more important than ever. And I know you agree with that.
Yes, I do. No qualms for me there whatsoever. So, lots of food for thought, you guys, and we so appreciate your support and your listenership. And also, we'd love to hear from you guys. And so if you have thoughts on this program or thoughts on anything I or Ray have said, whether you agree or disagree, we want to hear from you. So as always, please send us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. And of course, if you like the program and you're listening on iTunes, please leave us a 5-star review, because we majorly appreciate that. And that actually helps bump our visibility up so other people can listen to the program too.
Yeah. So if you made it this long, you like the program. So please just give us a good rating. Sorry.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Okay. You guys have a wonderful week, and we will talk to you later.